Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hi there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, bop-a-doo-wop-bop-doo-wop-a-dippy-dop-bop-doo-wop. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
That's always what we say. I'm Joe McCormick.
Yeah, and together we look at the future and we really kind of break it down. We look at sort of the technologies and trends that are in the present. We try to project out to the future. It can be kind of tricky. And today we're talking about something that's particularly tricky and a little, maybe controversial is not the right word, but there's debate about it. And it's all about...
I think that might be the right word.
Yeah, there's discussion about social media, its role in society, and how it may be affecting us on perhaps a biological level.
Affecting us?
Yes.
Social media.
You mean we're not just totally resilient, passive, you know?
You mean the media that we consume also consumes us? Yeah.
There is this thing called plasticity. The brain has it, as it turns out, and it means that that the brain can change based upon the things that we encounter. And normally this is something that can happen over a fairly significant amount of time. But the whole that's one of the reasons why human beings are so resilient, is that we are capable of adapting to changes in our environment.
Right, but it can happen both ways. So
sure.
If you have, say, a traumatic experience, like you're in a car accident or something like that, it can change your brain thereafter, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, we see that. I mean, there are lots of...
I don't mean just like physical damage to the brain, but that you can have a traumatic experience and be...
That can change the way that your thought patterns work later on.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I would argue post-traumatic stress disorder is a manifestation of that. We also see this in ways that are not necessarily associated with trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people who are very well adjusted because of their... because of multiple reasons. We can't really boil it down to one thing, but that's kind of getting ahead of ourselves. To really understand this, we thought we'd first start with a quick discussion about where we are with social media right now. Like, how big a deal is it? Is it really a big deal?
I think it's officially a big deal.
Yeah?
It's funny.
I'm not only saying that because that's my job here at How
yeah.
Stuff Works. But
right.
Yeah.
Lauren is both justifying her position and making a valid argument.
It's kind of scary that I can't remember a time without it. I mean, I can, but I just feel like, oh, yeah.
It's always
We've always
there.
Had
I,
Facebook.
I remember, yeah. I remember being on MySpace and thinking this new Facebook thing's never going to take off.
Wow. I felt like that about Twitter. When Twitter first came out, I was like, 140 characters. Who can say anything in that?
That's right. I made fun of Twitter when it first came out. I was like, this is ridiculous.
I wrote the article on Twitter and I made fun of it. It was only about it was only about 3 months after I wrote the article that I actually created an account and stuck with it. But the point being that this is a trend that has really taken off over the last several years. When you get to the point where Facebook has over 1 billion registered users, it's a big thing.
Yeah. As of May 2013, there are 665 million daily active users on Facebook.
That's huge. And then we've got all these different surveys we can talk about that sort of extrapolate how much people rely on social networks and what they use it for. According to the Pew Internet Personal Networks and Communities Survey, it polled 2,512 adults. So, first of all, let's go ahead and acknowledge that. That's a
relatively
small sample size
yeah.
Right? And then they extrapolate from that. Let's keep that in mind. They said that 79% of American adults said they use the internet, and nearly half of adults, which was around 47%, said that they use at least one social networking service. So,
and I believe this was in 2008 that they took this survey.
Right.
So that's also a thing
these numbers have changed.
Yes.
But remember, again, this 2,500 random people, we don't know who they called. They could have called a couple of senior living centers, and the seniors might say, no, I don't use anything like that. I do get on the internet, but I don't use a social networking service.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that out of the ones they surveyed, 92% of them used Facebook. So it was overwhelmingly the social networking service of choice among the people they surveyed. 29% said that they used MySpace. So I would hope this would be back in 2008. And 18% used LinkedIn and 13% used Twitter. And again, that makes sense. Again, if you're talking about 2008, that's young days for Twitter.
Sure. As of December 2012, Twitter had about 200 million monthly active users. So compared to that, 665.
Yeah.
Million.
And
how
so,
many tweets is that?
I mean,
it's hard to say because some people never send out a Twitter message at all. You know, they get on Twitter and they follow people, but they aren't generating their own messages. They're just following other folks.
Only a relatively small percent of people on the internet are actually creating new content. It's something like less than a fourth. And everyone else is basically just reposting.
I'm one of those people creating. No one's reposting it, though, so I'm not really contributing in any meaningful way. And that's fine. I'm all right with that. I wouldn't repost my stuff either. Now, so on top of that, we also have some stats from a Nielsen and NM Insight social media report that gives us a little bit more data about some of the more recent trends. One of those being that if you look at all the time being spent on the internet, and this is social networking sites included, but everything else added on top of that, they found that in July 2012, people spent 520.1 billion minutes on the internet. So, you know, more than half a trillion minutes in 1 month on the internet. Now, out of that, 20% of the time that was spent on PCs was on some sort of social networking site, and 30% of the time spent on mobile devices would be on social networking sites. So that tells us also that the growth for the mobile market is exploding.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you hear. Mobile's the trend, right? For social media, they're trying to fit it down to that form.
Exactly. And that same survey said that that mobile accounted for 63% of year-over-year growth in social media. In fact, I believe PCs took a little bit of a dip in the in that trend, but mobile more than made up for it. And we're seeing that more and more, and you know that just means that it's always just a touch away. You've often got one of these devices
between Wi-Fi and 3G. It's you're never really not connected if you're in the continental United States, certainly.
Yeah. So that raises some questions. If you are always, or for all practical purposes, always connected to social media and the internet, how could that possibly affect you beyond just the fact that you can tweet out what you're eating any given time of the day? So this is actually where we've got some disagreements in various circles about how much does all this social networking actually affect us? Does it just give us yet another outlet so that we can connect with people? Or is it supplanting our tendency to form real, lasting relationships with people? Or is it actually rewiring our brains to the point where the normal kind of social interactions we would associate with face-to-face meetings no longer are supported? That we are essentially raising a generation of people who are incapable of having an interaction face-to-face and pick up on things like facial cues and other little social cues.
Rewiring brains. Now, I just saw this language come up all over the place on this topic. And it got me a little curious. Does that originate anywhere?
What, rewiring the brain?
Well, I mean, this exact language, that it's going to rewire your kid's brain.
I would argue that, well, I'll tell you, someone who definitely used that phrase and similar phrases over and over again, and it's someone who is very prominent in scientific circles, particularly in the UK, and that was Susan Greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan Greenfield, better known as Baroness Greenfield, for she does hold that title.
She's a neuroscientist.
Neuroscientist, right? And was, until 2010, the director of the Royal Institution of Great Britain. And as such, she had a very prominent role as a scientist, someone who would popularize science and was very active in courting the media to talk about science. And that's an important job. We've seen lots of people take up that mantle, either officially or unofficially. We've seen a lot of it, ironically enough, on social media.
Absolutely. People like Phil Plait and people, talking, getting in there.
Professor Brian Cox, not the actor, but the professor out of the UK who does some fantastic work. He talks a lot about fusion. Phil Plait, of course, the bad astronomer, talks a lot about astronomy. There are a lot of others, too, who have used social networking to get information about science across and make people excited. Susan Greenfield has used her position to talk about her concerns about social media and its effect on the way we think and the way we create these interpersonal relationships and maybe even the way our brains develop. One of the fears that she has expressed was that by kind of channeling people's interactions online and removing that face-to-face interaction, mm-hmm. at least to some extent.
Sort of the traditional personal model of friendship.
Right, that this would lead the human brain to develop differently and the parts of the brain that would develop with all that interaction, that face-to-face interaction, would
atrophy and
or not even develop in the first
mm-hmm.
place.
Right.
And that so you would have, again, this sort of generation of children who grow up to be adults who cannot really interact in a face-to-face physical environment effectively.
Well, that sounds alarming if we have research indicating that social media is destroying our children's brains.
It would in fact be alarming if we had such research, but therein lies one of the problems. So one of the big criticisms leveled against Greenfield, and many, many people have brought this up, is that she would tend to have these discussions but not really have an actual study that she was citing to show that there was a demonstrable effect. That it was almost like it was armchair psychology or armchair neurobiology. The idea that, well, I do know that the brain can be affected by things, and I know that this is a growing trend that is becoming more and more important. And
therefore,
using that, I have to come to the conclusion that this trend is affecting people's brains. But without the – and she may very well be right. Let's go ahead and say
sure,
that. She
yeah.
could be absolutely right. But there's no real – hard evidence to point that way.
Yeah, from what I read, it seemed more like this was emanating from the intuitions of an established authority rather than empirical data.
Right, the argument from authority, which is a logical fallacy.
Oh, right, and there is plenty of research being done about this. Back in 2005, one of the big studies that you might hear quoted about social isolation and the internet was done by Norman Nye and the Stanford Institute for the Quantitative Study of Society. And it found that people who use the internet at that time, it was 31% of the U.S. population. They had extrapolated mm-hmm. of those that use the internet frequently. They spend 70 minutes less daily interacting with their family, which sounds scary. I mean, because you know, family interaction is a big important thing.
Sure.
And 70 minutes, you know, of 24 hours. That's a sizable chunk of time. However, you know, this was in 2005, before social media, social networking was really out there. You know, people weren't going to be on Facebook in 2005 talking to their aunt. so that's part of that. And also, it's Norman Nye has admitted to being an internet addict. He's self-professed in this. And so I feel like possibly his findings are a little bit colored by that. And therefore, yeah, when people throw around numbers from the study, that it's maybe not as unbiased or as clear-cut here in 2013 as it otherwise could be.
Right. Well, I mean, the difference between 2005 and 2013, it might be one thing in, I don't know, bacteriology, but in internet use and social media, this is like a century, you know. It's so different now.
Yeah, and again, you know, this is one of those things where I think the problem is that it's so young that we don't have enough scientific rigor there to really be able to say one way or the other.
Well, there are a lot of problems with this, right? I mean, first of all, yes, it's the widespread social media phenomenon is extremely new, and so there just hasn't been enough research. Number two, even if it had been around for a while, it's hard to conduct studies on this kind of thing because
right.
you're studying social phenomenon where there's a lot of variables and
right.
it's difficult to pin down causes.
Exactly, like in a traditional scientific inquiry. Let's say that we are studying, we're trying to determine the effects of a particular chemical reaction, for example. And if you were really studying that in a scientific way, you would try to eliminate as many other variables as possible so that you could be reasonably certain that any effect you observed was in fact a result of that chemical reaction,
mm-hmm.
right? So you would want to make sure that your instruments were properly cleaned and calibrated and all of this so that you could you could eliminate,
isolate the variable.
Right. Yeah. Eliminate anything that's going to cause a problem. The problem with the social science is not maybe a problem is the wrong word. The challenge is that you can't eliminate the variables. Frequently used methodologies is the survey, which, you know, we kind of mm-hmm. opened up talking about surveys, but surveys themselves, you can't eliminate all those other variables that go into a person's background that may guide him or her to make certain choices. So you could say, out of all the people we surveyed, 90% said they're using social networking services more and interacting with people, real people, less. But
In a study like that, to be honest, I have no idea how much I use social media. Like, if you were to ask me, I'd have to guess. And that would show up on a survey as some kind of guess, you know, whatever number I estimated. That might have really no bearing on how much time I actually spend staring at Facebook.
That can change.
Of course. Yeah, day to day, hour to hour. Hopefully they would be using some kind of a computer tracking method, some kind of digital tracking method to actually look at the number of hours you did spend doing that thing.
I mean, that would be more accurate, but
a survey usually the way that these things go.
And also, even if you were able to show that there was some sort of correlation between the two, you can't be certain that there's causation, because there could be other factors that you did not control for that are impacting that situation.
Yeah, that would make the experiment even more difficult, because you'd have to isolate all the different, different variables.
How many of those people moved away from home to go work somewhere else, and therefore all of the mm-hmm. people that were part of their social network are now 1,000 miles away? Maybe the social networking sites is how they maintain the real relationships they've already developed.
Absolutely. There's been a bunch of medical research done into people with physical and mental disabilities, figuring out that actually for these folks, social media is very useful in maintaining and forging new relationships.
Right. And according to the Pew Internet study, which again dated from several years ago, they said that the people who were using social networking sites were 45% more likely to visit a cafe, 52% more likely to visit a library, 34% more likely to visit a fast food restaurant, 69% more likely to visit other restaurants, and 42% more likely to visit a public park, saying that the image that people have in their minds of the person who has sequestered him or herself into
socially,
the basement.
Socially isolated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just sitting down and on the computer and they never go outside, that is a fallacy. But they also said that bloggers, people who are actively posting things on the internet for others to read, were 72% more likely to belong to a local voluntary association than those who do not blog. And that 61% of all the people who are using the web regularly often talk to a neighbor at least once per month. And that may, in fact, be higher than people who don't use the web frequently. So these are not – again, nothing here is telling me specifically that internet use and social networking sites in particular – are positively or negatively impacting our ability to socialize outside the realm of the web. There's conflicting information. Some of it, you know, seems very intuitive. Like, if you were to tell me that people using social networking sites more and more frequently is resulting in a higher instance of people misunderstanding social cues in physical settings, I would think that makes total sense to me. Intuitively, that makes sense. But we don't have the hard data there yet, so we really need to hold off on making any assumptions, even though we may have some preliminary information that seems to either support or contradict that conclusion.
Right, and there are overall societal trends that are in effect here and have been working, I think, since the Industrial Revolution at least.
Sure.
Wherein, you know, a couple of the numbers that get thrown around is that as of the 1980s or so, before the internet really hit, people had about 3 close social contacts. And they're talking about confidants. They're talking about someone who you can go to when you have a serious problem and hash it out with them.
Right.
Show up at 2 a.m. with strange package wrapped in a carpet.
Right, yeah. The people who will help you move a body.
Yeah. The what's in the box people.
Right.
And that this number has gone down to about 1.8. since you know, whatever, you know, a few decades ago. And that's, I don't know. I mean, you know, it is significant, certainly. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think that the internet, other things have gone on the planet.
Sure.
Besides the internet since then.
Again, that's why the whole social science stuff is so complicated, because while it's simple for us to say, hey, this coincides with the rise of the internet, there are all these other things that also happen in that span of time.
And
you know, we've also seen the move to urban areas growing year over year over year. So that's another factor that you have to consider when you're thinking about these things. It's complicated is what we're saying.
It's very complicated. And also, you know, the fear that the media that we use changes us is certainly not a new thing. Socrates was really concerned that reading and writing was going to ruin people's brains, that memory was going to be so weakened that we would all be infants
in two generations. There were people who were afraid that the printing press was going to completely ruin the brains of everybody. I think that was mostly monks who were really hoping to keep on that illumination and uh-huh. manuscript writing. Then you had things, radio, television, and this also really applies to the youth as well, where there's this fear that social networking sites is really changing the way young people think. But the same argument has been made time and time again for lots of different stuff, like rock and roll.
Oh,
and,
sure.
You know,
think of the children.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think that also this is why, you know, horror movies today are things like, you know, children like Samara in The Ring showing up being a product of technology versus Rosemary's Baby being a product of
Satan.
Yeah. So, well, or medical science or whatever you want to attribute that kind of thing to.
Nice that the pop culture references are flying fast and furious. There's another one. Diesel there. Now, I do want to say that even though we don't really know right now what the effects of social networking services are on us neurologically, that's not to say that there isn't an effect and that we won't always be in the dark about it. I do think that we will figure that out as time goes on. I think that's going to change as time goes on. But I also am not so worried about saying, you know, stay away from social networking sites. It's going to ruin your kids' brains. I don't really believe that. I think that humans are more resilient. I think that we are capable of adapting to new situations and to retain old methods of communication as well. I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where people are so concentrated on social networking sites that if you put two people in a room together, they can't have a meaningful conversation. I think that's unrealistic.
I think part of the fear here is the old cyborg fear.
Yeah.
I mean, people are at the core of it, they're afraid of having some kind of human biological essence corrupted by the invasion of this foreign synthetic kind of thing. And that's what the technological incarnation of a social network represents.
Mm-hmm.
It seems more steel and wires and plastic than human flesh. But I think it's something we're going to get over, because we got over it with every other technology that has ever enabled human interaction before. I mean, we got, like, there was a time when you couldn't write letters to people who were far away, and then you could.
And then there was a time where you couldn't communicate in real time with someone who was 100 miles
away. Right.
Right.
When the generation that did not grow up with social networking goes into decline, then I think that's going to be the basic.
Well, the other point being that even let's say that the worst case scenario, according to what I guess Baroness Greenfield would say, is true. Let's say the worst case scenario is that it's fundamentally changing the way people's brains are, quote unquote, wired. How do we know that that's necessarily a bad thing? We're judging that based upon what our own perceptions of good and bad are right now. But if you were to project yourself out 20 years into the future and you're in a world where that's just the norm, that's not to say that people then would consider it to be a bad thing or that they had actually lost anything. There may be other elements of social interaction that we have not yet considered that would be very much the norm for them, and it would be fine.
Yeah, what if it's actually, I mean, assuming it is rewiring our brains, which, again, we don't have any necessarily good reason to believe, what if it makes our lives more fulfilling?
Right. And then, again, to look at the future, there's the whole idea of reaching this level of augmented reality.
Yeah.
Where the social networking reality and our physical reality mesh, and they are a new thing. They're all,
and
it's just reality.
Added dimension rather than, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think this is an artificial distinction anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to make my case. You go home and you get on Facebook and you talk to people maybe that you were talking to at work a couple hours earlier. And there's this assumption that you're doing something fundamentally different in these two ways,
mm-hmm.
but you're communicating either way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're communicating with an avatar that maps to a real person and they're getting what the message you send and they're sending messages back. It's no more artificial than, like we were just saying, a letter or a phone call. I think that this idea that there's the real world and then there's the internet is something that's going to go away with time. The internet is part of the world. The
right.
internet is the real world.
Yeah. Right. And with that overlay, that'll become even more of a seamless integration, right?
Exactly, yeah. With augmented reality, it's going to become even more impossible to ignore the fact that this distinction is artificial.
Right.
When you have Google Glass, say, and you have what we would probably call, I think we called in our video, social reality,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, you can walk around your environment, and so you see the world you live in annotated with the likes and comments and whatever new kinds of feedback there are from your friends and family.
Right.
I mean, that's a more social world than we've ever had before.
Yeah. At that point, it actually becomes a challenge to filter your world to your preferences so that you're not just overwhelmed with information from all those social contacts that you actually have.
Well, you can always take the glasses off.
Right. There's that. For now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. This was a fun conversation. Guys, if you have suggestions for topics we should cover in Forward Thinking and you just want to be part of the conversation, we highly recommend you get in touch with us. You can do that via email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com, or go to fwthinking.com, and that's where we've got all the blogs, the podcasts, we've got the videos, we've got links to all of our social media sites, so you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Google+. Come join us. Be part of this great future that we are forging together. We're really excited to have you over there and to be part of this conversation. We really want you there. And so we will talk to you again soon. And remember, Gwyneth Paltrow's head, that's what's in the box.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.